This podcast is offered by Jikoji Zen Center on the web at jikoji.org. Our programs are made possible by donations from people like you.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to a beautiful sunny day at Jikoji. It's a rare event here so far this year. We've had just so many wonderful winter days here with rain and sleet and wind and snow and hail. And it feels unusual for it to be 60 degrees, but here we are. Today I'm going to talk a little bit about the Heart Sutra. We've been studying it during this practice period between the Nehane Sesshin that was in February and our Tanjue Sesshin, which is coming up in the first week of April, which everyone's invited to participate in. But first, I want to share a little bit about the dynamism of Zazen, what we practice in our meditation. It seems like it's a pretty chill thing we do. We just come and sit on our cushion. We're quiet. We don't move, mostly. We just breathe and pay attention. But I want to share something from one of the teachers, both Mike and I, studied with Katagiri Roshi, and he talks about Zazen. So I'm just going to read this. All we have to do is manifest ourselves based on real reality, where our practice is authentic. The heart of sitting itself is attaining Buddha. Zazen is completely, absolutely the fruit of practicing Buddha's teaching, practicing authentic tradition of Buddha's teaching. In Zazen, we manifest ourselves in full revelation in the form of Buddha, with three categories of our karma, our body, our mouth, and our mind. Dogen says that there are some schools that practice chanting of Buddha's name. Dogen says that is like a frog in a rice field. Whatever you say, whatever you do, important point is you have to do with whole body and mind, using fully the three categories of our karma, the body, mouth, and mind. Zazen enables us to plunge into the purest situation of human life in dynamic motion, which is vivified. Now, it seems like Zazen is not dynamic motion, but Zazen is dynamic motion. And when I'm sleeping on my cushion, I forget that. You should also know, basically, we lack nothing of the highest enlightenment. Yes, all activities are Zen practice. All of you are Buddha, 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 Buddha. You should know that basically we lack nothing of the highest enlightenment. We are forever endowed with it. Since we are unable to be in complete accord with it, though, we have to a way of giving rise to random intellections, and by chasing them as if they were real, we stumble vainly on the great way, which means our treasure given to us by our father, our true father, and I think he means Buddha, this universe, this treasure of consciousness and being that we are given is already lost, and we're stumbling. This point is very delicate. Basically, whatever you do, all activity is completely identical with Buddha nature. That is true. If our lives are completely based on Buddha nature, why is it all people, human beings, must stumble in their daily life vainly, day in and day out? Often we are very delighted in our experience of stumbling. Such is human life. That is why we need philosophy, psychology, biology, physics, religion, and many other things. So why do we come to practice Zazen? The practice is to manifest yourself in full revelation right now, right here. Buddhism is not to enable you to become a blind man or woman. Buddhism always says you should become an adult, not an adult baby. You should become adult, which means you should use your brain fully and completely. You should plunge completely into the middle of the authentic tradition of Buddha's teaching. That is the way which an adult must follow vividly and wholeheartedly. So with that dynamic presence we bring to Zazen, it allows us to examine our life. And the Heart Sutra that we chanted is considered the essence of Mahayana Buddhism. It has just, even though I think within 4 or 5 minutes we chant this sutra, it touches on just about all elements of existence. And I want to speak of a couple of them that are contained in the Heart Sutra just to show that in a way when we chant the Heart Sutra, it's like looking out into the woods and you can see various things. But when you look at the particulars, it's like vast. Much like you look at a piece of moss, these trees we have are, the trunks, many of them are covered with moss. And when the air has moisture in it, they just are vibrant and extended. And yet you can look at a piece of moss and then you could take a little piece of it and look at it again and it's a fractal. It keeps, and you go smaller and it's still a fractal. And likewise, when we examine our lives and the Heart Sutra, it is that way. So in a way, I'm going to cover a lot of territory, but just kind of let it flow over you. I want to just kind of show the terrain that Buddhism encompasses or expresses. We talk about the five skandhas are empty, the five aggregates. The five aggregates are defined as form, feeling, sensation, impulses, consciousness. That's one way they're defined. But these skandhas, each one of them is a very deep, involved aspect. Like the first one, form, is materiality, which includes whatever has dimension, and it consists of the four great elements, and everything that is derived from the four great elements. That is form, or materiality. The four great elements are earth, which is solid, water, which is liquid, air, vapor, gaseous, and fire, which is heat. And what are derived from the four great elements include not only the materiality of the world that we see, but also our sense organs. Like our eye is the manifestation of sentient materiality, as is our nose, ear, tongue, body, and mind, resulting in sight, sound, smell, taste, touch, and objects of mind. And within form is also unmanifest action. It seems odd that there would be unmanifest action in form. However, it's a residual force. It's defined as a residual force of potentiality that is not perceptible, and it also doesn't offer resistance and is left over from manifest action or meditational concentration. And so in our meditation, we can also bring this clear attention that can result in unmanifest action that follows. So that's all part of form, just form, one of the skandhas. The second one is feelings. And experiences are of three kinds, pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. And way more can be said about feelings. And then there's perceptions and cognitions, which are grasping at signs of the sense objects. And there are three kinds of sense objects, the indefinite, the definite, and the immeasurable. And when we look at signs, we might look at something and say, oh, what is this? I don't know. But you see it like this, and it's a cup or a bell. And so there's the indefinite aspects of things we see that might even pique our curiosity. Then there are the definite things that we know. We recognize the signs of their existence, that this is a lectern. That's what I call it. And so we put words to it. And then we also can perceive the immeasurable, the vastness of space or the ends of the universe. We can imagine the ends of the universe or the beginning of time or the end of time or the great apocalypse or a utopian world. We have a perception of immeasurability of space and of the ocean and many other things. The fourth skanda are impulses. We say impulses, but the other temples, they say formations or mental formations or fabrications or motivational dispositions. So, we have forms, feelings, perceptions, and then we have these motivational dispositions that are derived from these other three skandhas, and they include many, many things. We say impulses, but that's just a pin in the page that lets you know there's a whole range of other things, and I'm going to read these off, which include feelings and perceptions, but also include contact, physical contact, mental attention, volitions, zest, confidence, memory of mindfulness, meditational concentration, insight, faith, inner shame, dread of blame, the root of the beneficial of lack of greed, lack of hostility, lack of confusion, the tranquility, carefulness, equanimity, attitude of non-harming, attachment, aversion, pride, ignorance, views, doubt, anger, malice, hypocrisy, maliciousness, envy, selfishness, deceitfulness, guile, mischievous exuberance, desire to harm, lack of shame, lack of dread of blame, mental fogginess, excitedness, lack of faith, sloth, carelessness, loss of mindfulness, distractedness, lack of recognition, regret, torpor, initial mental application, and discursive thought. So these are all motivational dispositions that arise out of these other three skandhas. But they also require the fifth skandha, which is consciousness, which include many different kinds of consciousness, the eye consciousness, nose consciousness, ear consciousness, body consciousness, mind consciousness. And some of these things, when people in the past have looked at these, they've looked at that actually eye consciousness relies on other kinds of consciousness to actually clearly perceive what our eye has, that the eye consciousness itself cannot discern by itself. It has to be included with other memory, storehouse consciousness aspects, the feelings and perceptions we have surrounding that. And consciousness is also considered an appropriating consciousness because our consciousness actually appropriates our body. thankfully. So consciousness also joins an assemblage of aspects pertaining to an organism into a felt relationship and continues as a series of moment events. So we talk about just the present moment. There's nothing other than the present moment, but the present moment is also composed of moment events. And we have an extended moment event here of doing our zazen here and coming in here to hear this talk. So to give a little more depth to how some of these skandhas are described, I'm going to read just one aspect of one motivational disposition that is described in this sutra that defines these skandhas with great refinement, I'll say. And this is, there are probably hundreds of pages describing these different skandhas and the different aspects, but I want to take you through how Buddhists have looked at these. So bear with me here. So this is the Book of Causation. It's a connected discourse on the elements, and it talks about desires and dependence on the diversity of elements and so on. So the Buddha said, bhikkhus, sensual thoughts arise with a source, not without a source. Thought of ill will arises with a source, not without a source. Thought of harming arises with a source, not without a source. And how is this so? In dependence on the sensuality element, there arises sensual perception. In dependence on sensual perception, there arises sensual intention. In dependence on sensual intention, there arises sensual desire. In dependence on sensual desire, there arises sensual passion. In dependence on sensual passion, there arises a sensual quest. Engaged in a sensual quest, the uninstructed worldling conducts himself wrongly in three ways, with body, speech, and mind. With dependence on the ill will element, there arises perception of ill will. In dependence on perception of ill will, there arises intention of ill will. In dependence on intention of ill will, there arises desire driven by ill will. In dependence on desire driven by ill will, there arises passion driven by ill will. In dependence on passion driven by ill will, there arises a quest driven by ill will. Engaged in a quest driven by ill will, the uninstructed worldling conducts himself wrongly in three ways: body, speech, and mind. In dependence on the harmfulness element, there arises perception of harming. In dependence on perception of harming, there arises intention of harm. In dependence on intention of harm, there arises desire of harm. That's dependent on passion to harm, dependent on quest to harm. Engaged in a quest to harm, the uninstructed worldling conducts himself wrongly in three ways, with body, speech, and mind. Suppose, bhikkhus, a man would drop a blazing grass torch into a thicket of dry grass. If he does not quickly extinguish it with his hands and his feet, the creatures living in the grass and wood would meet with calamity and disaster. So too, if any ascetic or Brahmin or Buddhist practitioner does not quickly abandon, dispel, obliterate, and annihilate the unrighteous perceptions that have arisen in him. He dwells in suffering in this very life with vexation, despair, and fever, and with the breakup of the body after death, a bad destination may be expected for him. Bhikkhus, thought of renunciation arises with a source, not without a source. Thought of non-ill will arises with a source, not without a source. Thought of harmlessness arises with a source, not without a source. And how is that so? In dependence on the renunciation element, there arises perception of renunciation. Dependent on perception of renunciation, there arises intention of renunciation. That arises from the desire for renunciation. That arises from passion for renunciation. And a quest for renunciation. Engaged in a quest for renunciation, the instructed noble disciple conducts himself rightly in three ways, and with body, speech, and mind. And it goes on to talk about the dependence on the non-ill will element and the dependence on the harmlessness element. And you can see that there are many steps that lead to each of these things. And going back to the one describing about the dependence on the ill will element, you know, we've seen so much horrific acts recently over these last many years, and it's not just the act is a final culmination of a perception that arises from an intention for ill will, dependent on a desire for ill will, driven by passion. You know, all these things, there are steps along the way. And so by the time an act has been committed, there's already a path, a well-worn path that's led to that those moments. And perhaps in our skillful ways, you know, when we're parents or teachers or managers or even friends, and you can sense perceptions of ill will. You know, that's where it needs to stop. If there's an intention for ill will or passion for ill will, you know, you're getting closer and closer to actually committing an act of ill will with body, speech, and mind. So that's one tiny strand of these skandhas. Along this line of this progression that I've just expounded, the Heart Sutra also we chant that there is no ignorance and also no extinction of it and so forth until no old age and death and also no extinction of them. This ignorance to old age and death is another whole vast thread describing the causal links that are described in Buddhism. They talk about 12 causal links. I think there has to be an infinite number of causal links that can exist. But the way they're defined is there's ignorance, motivational, fabrications, consciousness, name and form, the six sense bases, the contact, feeling, craving, clinging, existence, birth, aging and death. That also includes sorrow, pain, displeasure, and despair. So those are the 12 causal links. And in order for ignorance to exist, the absence of ignorance must exist. In order for contact to exist, the absence of contact must exist, be present. In order for birth to exist, the absence of birth must also exist. In order for old age and pain to exist, an absence of them must also exist. This big, we have this big soup of existence that's in flux. It's in dynamic motion. And if it weren't in flux, if this lectern were always an lectern and could not be anything other than a lectern, it would have no relationship with anything else in existence. And so really, in order for things to have a relationship with something else, it has to have these conditions that cause it to exist for however long it exists until it becomes a piece of firewood or it might become a board that you put out on the ground that mice or snakes would like to live under. Then it becomes a roof. It's a roof. It might become a table a flat table if we lift up these edges. You know, there are all the, fortunately, we have this dynamic, vital change that happens that we may be born and die. And yet, it seems like in this practice, our practice is to see through all of this, that we can live in harmony with it all. So I'm going to stop here and open it up to conversation or questions. Yes.
So let's say we go back and trace the source where ill will or desires come through. What happens then? Like, what do you do with the source?
You witness it. You experience the source. You see it for what it is, and then you have the opportunity to take the next step or not. I think when you look at the source of these, you also then see the threads of how it connects to other things, like ill will. For example, the source of ill will. It might relate to a circumstance of mistreatment that someone else engaged in. And so when you can see it that this person engaged in ill will, and you're not going down the path of like taking that passion to taking your creating an intention and then a passion and committing an act, that instead you say, wait a second here. And this is what happens in meditation, is ability to look at this as it is, can say, I feel ill will. I have a feeling of ill will. And where did that come from? And can look at, an easy one is like when you're driving on the freeway and somebody cuts you off. You know, it's like, you know, you want to go faster so that they can't quite fit in, or what do you do? And it could be their peripheral vision's not right. It could be they got an important meeting and they're trying to get there and they have anxiety in them. And yet, so our ill will is projected onto something that is ignorant of what was done, what was maybe how close a call it was. You know, and yet you want to tell them. You want to tell them how close a call it was. So, but when you can see that ill will forming and in that circumstance and say, I feel ill will, then the mental construction takes a time out to examine the feeling of where the feeling is, of reviewing the circumstance again. And when your focus goes from the circumstance and becomes reflective of like, I'm feeling this, the cycle of continuing development of intention and passion and acting out is delayed, if not dissolved. So with that ill will, I can follow that person to where they're going to park and say, hey, you know, you really freaked me out, you know? And that might really freak them out. I did something really stupid. I mean, many, 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 many times. I don't remember today what stupid I did, but not yet. But there was one time I was coming down Skyline. I was coming back from work, and I pulled off the road because there was a guy who was fast behind me, and he wanted to do the curves going down to Skylanda, and I thought, you know, go ahead. And then I pull out to get going again, and another guy gets right behind me real hard, and I pull over for him, and I let him go down. But then I don't put on my brakes, and I just follow him, and I get really close. I got really, really close to him. And he comes to a complete stop, and I go around him, and I just keep going. But he follows me. I thought, okay. That's kind of stupid, Doug. What's going to happen now? So I drive along and I keep driving for another 5 miles and I get up to the lookout. You know, it looks out over Stanford campus, that big parking area up the road about, what is it, 4 or 5 miles. It'd be a long drive to go up there today because the road's shut down right now that way. But he's right behind me. He's keeping a nice distance, but he's right behind me, and I pull into that parking place, and he pulls in right behind me, right beside me. And so I get out, and he's a guy in army fatigues. And he says to me, do you know what force is? And I look at him, and I say, yeah. Force of gravity is very strong. I knew what he meant. And so we talked, and I invited him here to have dinner. And he took a rain check. But, you know, that was like a stupid circumstance of like, you know, come on, dude, we're on one of the most beautiful highways on the planet. And you're tailgating me? You know, why would you tailgate me? And then I tailgate him. And so, you know, somehow out of this whole, it could have gone really bad because the guy probably had a weapon in his car, you know. He was one who, he was a veteran from Afghanistan. And, you know, and coming back here to the United States where you're not treated with respect, and your brothers that you lived with and died with, or they died near you and you had all these experiences, has no relationship to this peaceful existence we have here in the United States. They come back and they're torn. They're deeply torn. And so how close are they to actually being out of control with body, speech, and mind? You know, it's those kind of people need help and compassion, not anger, to get them out of it, out of where they are. So I asked him, you know, I said, were you in the Marines? And he said, no, I was in the Army. And I thanked him for his service. I said, it must be really hard being back here. And I touched a tender spot in him, and I could see him melt and almost start to weep. And he said, I gotta go. And he got in his Jeep and he took off. And I felt I had done several things wrong. You know, not only tailgated him, but you know, how that I wasn't able to hold his sensitivity in some way, and kindly. You know, it felt like it began to come, and there I was grateful for that, and he withdrew. So, but maybe it wasn't a mistake on my part, but you know, it just made me a lot more mindful that when something untoward happens to me on the road, that there are all these different frames of mind we have, all these different times, and our frames of mind shift all the time. And to claim territory, this is my lane, I'm going this fast, is perhaps a little too egotistical. Egoism and territoriality go hand in hand. So I don't know if this helped a little. Looking at the source. Yes.
You mentioned when there is ignorance, there is also lack of ignorance. Mm-hmm. When ignorance is created, there's also, well, I don't know if it was created, but when it is, there's also the non of it. Could you speak more? Having a hard time grounding it. It's very abstract.
Well, in a way, all things come out of ignorance. And the unknown, we stumble and bumble around and find our way. But then by stubbing my toe on a leg of a table. That was really an ignorant act, to stub my toe on that table. However, in that moment, I found the edge of the table, and I found the edge of my body, and they made contact. So there's illumination in that moment. And one by one, you know, what we don't understand maybe does become understood, but it takes stepping back from our ego, stepping back from our this life we possess so possessively, to see the connections with I call this the leg of a table, but it's actually part of the earth element. And what a magnificent table. And there might be all sorts of revelations that come out of that. So out of the unknown comes the known. That's about all I can say. Yes, Ross.
Well, it's interesting you brought up Afghanistan. I was listening to something that said it's the 18th year of the war, and they were trying to sort of summarize like the 18 years history of the war and how much money it cost. They were trying to put into context just how much money it had cost the United States. And of course, they talked to veterans and talked about just, you know, the fact that it really hasn't accomplished anything in 18 years in terms of Afghanistan. And like you say, it just leaving this trail of suffering. And to me, you know, I haven't really paid that much attention to it just because it's so depressing. And so to go back to your thing about, you know, in meditation, it's like the tendency for something like that is, it's like overwhelming in the sense that you feel like you have nothing. It's just like your country's run amok. It's like a cancer that you can't do anything about. And so thinking about it is depressing, but ignoring it somehow. I don't know if you have any thoughts about how to like be with it in a way that makes it somehow transformed, or just how to be with that, something like that. It just seems to be like a cancer that, like, and like you said, the veterans come back and nobody, it's like nobody cares. It's like this war that goes on and nobody, well, at least Trump is saying, you know, we got to get out of here. But it just seems to go on and on without much public discourse.
It's not seen.
Yeah, it's like a cancer that people ignore, and yet it's, you know, billions of dollars every year and lives.
Trillions, like, isn't it 4 or 5 trillion now?
Anyway.
That was going to cost a few billion, you know, because we're going to take their oil. Yeah.
It's depressing, you know.
So how to maybe giving it, making it visible is important. Visibility brings attention, and attention brings curiosity, and curiosity brings investigation and opinion and policy out of that. So what do we do with it? We take best care of this life, and each act we do, each step, each breath is a clear opportunity to manifest our wholehearted practice. By having practice here at Jokoji, I think one of the many, many things that we do here is people come to this place, this valley, this temple, Zen center, and they feel something deeply reassuring, maybe a deep sense of peace that maybe that is quite natural for all beings to actually feel, and to feel a deep peace about their life puts it in a different perspective, so that when they go back into the world, they bring a little peace to their life, their actions, their relationships, little by little. Yeah. maybe there's more we can do. Maybe it's going to take, it takes, so much of this takes many, many, many different kinds of people working together to have it, something develop. And with critical mass of people doing certain things, certain actions can begin to happen. So by the peacefulness that maybe waves of peacefulness that leaves different places of practice, the influence can permeate into other places. But we're in such a gentle kind of pure, there can be a purity about this, but then how do you go out and deal with someone who has ill will? Matching it with ill will doesn't work. Kojim Trungpa talked to a bunch of Vietnam war protesters. They felt like the war has to end. We got to do something. We're not doing anything. How do we meet it? And you know, you're meeting the Vietnam was a war about anger, greed, and delusion. And what comes out of anger, greed, and delusion are very hard things like anger and hatred and ill will and possessiveness and more greed. And how do you meet that? And what Trungpa said was, be a marshmallow. Be flexible. So maybe that flexibility in the moment is provides openings for other perspectives and other things that follow from perception, that becomes intention, that becomes a quest for peace. And so these things are built, and I think our individual practice is one thing, but I think this practice of meditation, when we meet as a group of people, when we hold sesshins and have a group retreat, when we that there's something bigger than just any one of us that leaves this place. So the lunch bell rang. We have many really excellent cooks here. And one of them is cooked today. So let's go up and enjoy our lunch and have more conversation. Okay.
Thank you for listening to this podcast offered by Jokoji Zen Center. Our Dharma talks are offered free of charge, and this is made possible by the donations we receive. Your support helps us to continue to offer the Dharma. For more information about Jokoji, please visit us on the web at jokoji.org.